dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. Let's talk a little bit about the much-needed step that President Trump took by turning a Syrian airfield into rubble last week. Now, I believe we must enforce a no-exemptions rule against chemical weapons use by anyone, and for any other weapons of mass destruction for that matter. But what about the guy in Syria, Bashar al-Assad, who used them? And what about his puppet master, Vladimir Putin, who almost certainly knew and either endorsed it or just let it happen? Much bigger and tougher questions. And while we're at it, what happens when we cut down the ISIS black flag? Who will rule the areas they previously occupied in Iraq and Syria? I haven't heard much in the way of good ideas about those being bandied about, so I'll put mine into play. A while back, we wrote a book called Cut Down the Black Flag, with a plan to take out ISIS and their caliphate. It involved taking the handcuffing rules of engagement off U.S. troops already involved in the coalition, arming our only friend and the most effective fighting force in the area, the Kurds, and reinvigorating the partnership we had with the Sunni tribes in the ISIS-dominated areas of Iraq, the same tribes who helped us defeat al-Qaeda in Iraq during the surge. Now, if Obama had not cut and run from Iraq, we might have stayed to support the fragile democracy we bought with our blood and treasure, and we might not be fighting ISIS now, which grew in the vacuum he created. The Iraqi Federal Republic needed someone to make sure the majority Shia government in Baghdad, who were very much under the sway of the Iranians, held up their end of the deal that put them in power in the first place, specifically treating the other members of that government, the Kurds and Sunni, as partners, not vassals. Well, we left, and the Shia did what everyone with a clue knew they'd do. They treated the minority groups like dogs. That gave fertile ground for ISIS to metastasize in the Sunni areas. And the Syrian civil war gave them more unhappy Sunni areas there to recruit from, to conquer, and pretty soon you had the caliphate we all know and hate today. Well, now after 8 years of leading from well behind, the Iraqi government is even more controlled by the Iranian mullahs, and the effort to push ISIS out of the Sunni regions of Iraq and Syria has a heavy component of Iranian-backed Shia militias, the same Shia militias who killed thousands of Americans during the Iraq War and tens of thousands more Sunni during that period. Well, now they're indulging their sectarian hatred in a slaughter and looting fest through the regions ISIS formerly occupied. We help clear ISIS out, and the militias swoop in, rape, kill, pillage, and burn. And somehow, this is acceptable. Well, it's not. And so, on to my plan. Iraq and Syria are artificial constructs of the post-colonial era. The lines on the map that make up their borders are arbitrary, and honestly, a large part of the problem. They force people, Sunni, Shia, and Kurds, who not only don't like each other, but actually have beefs going back more than 1,000 years, to live in the same country and supposedly be able to put aside all that because some European drew lines in the sand saying so. What an absurd idea. Right now, the Kurds in Iraq have their own nation-state in every way other than international recognition. They're a good ally, and they deserve self-determination, not some requirement to deal with a Baghdad government that is at best unconcerned with them, and more often, openly hostile. Now, the Sunni are worse off, because unlike the Kurds, there is no oil in their part of the country. And the Iraqi government is basically fine with the Shia militias wiping out any possible resistance. But then who will govern once the smoke clears? You take down ISIS, they kill most of the military-age males, and there's no one left to actually run things. Well, that's what the Shia government in Baghdad actually wants. Across that non-existent border in Syria, Vladimir Putin and Russia have held firm to the idea that Assad must stay. But he is unable to actually govern most of what the map calls Syria, and there's no reason to believe he'll be able to do so going forward without a massive and ongoing oppressive iron sandal on the necks of his people, when he isn't actually slaughtering them. Plus, he is a member of an even smaller minority group, the Alawites, and they get no love from the mostly Sunni people they're trying to keep down. So, I'll go out on the last limb of the last tree here and say, why in the world would we continue to try and enforce these meaningless lines on a map that force these groups into countries they wouldn't choose themselves? Or if they did choose them, it would be just to rearrange the pecking order so they could be top dogs and oppress their previous oppressors. Why don't we throw it all out and start over? I mean, what about the possibility of self-determination for the region? I know, that's crazy talk. But is it? The Iraqi government and the majority of its population is Shia, and they largely live in the region spreading out from Baghdad. So let's call that Iraq, or Shiistan, or whatever, and that can be one country. Now, we've already noted that the Kurds essentially have a state called Kurdistan. So, how about a state for the Kurds called Kurdistan? Then, you move on to the Sunni areas of current Iraq where ISIS is being pushed out. As I said before, we once made a strong alliance with the tribal leaders there who are not the wild-eyed fanatics of ISIS, and many of whom just want to do their thing without feeling the need to burn anyone in any cages at all. So, let's have a Sunnistan of some flavor there. It will take some support since they don't have natural resources, but it's a lot cheaper than the open warfare and ISIS running rampant we currently have. And while we're at it, the Sunni regions stretch across that imaginary line into Syria. So let's erase that and unite the Sunni regions, and the tribes in all of that area can get together and make some form of representative government. Now back to Assad and his enabler, Vlad Putin. The Russians aren't going to give up their warm water port in Syria, so they need a puppet. But at this point, Assad really does need to go. So let's make a deal where the Russians pick a new puppet, and the people of Syria get to watch Assad swing from a gallows for his crimes. The much smaller Syria could be a home for the Alawites and other minority groups, and we don't need World War III to make it happen. Now, all of this is hardly as easy as drawing some new lines in a computer mapping program, but it has the huge advantage of not putting a bunch of dogs who hate each other in the same cage. We could also force the United Nations to take some time out of its busy schedule condemning Israel to actually put its stamp of approval on this and provide the diplomacy and teach them basic governance to make it all happen. Now, I'm not deluded enough to think we can just wave a magic wand and redraw some new, although much smarter, lines on a map and make all of this a Shangri-La. But do any of the other solutions, or lack of solutions, have a real chance of making this better? Not that I've seen, and just letting the thing fester along is hardly a plan. I take that back. It basically was the Obama plan, and we can certainly do better than that. Now, this is not a call for a massive U.S. troop presence, and we can even make some of the other interested parties do some peacekeeping. I think it's worth a try. So if you're listening, Mr. President, let's talk. I'm Jim Hansen, and if you enjoy these kind of cunning plans, my Twitter feed is full of them, @Uncle_Jimbo. Up next after the break, we are going to talk with Patrick Poole about the problem of known wolf terrorists.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Patrick Poole, who is the National Security and Terrorism Correspondent for PJ Media and someone who keeps a fairly strong eyeball on what the jihadists are doing and debunks and rebunks the conventional wisdom. Patrick, you have been pointing out for a long time that we have a problem when the media consistently reports that terrorist lone wolves are magically out of nowhere appearing and causing havoc, and that we should probably ignore anything else other than the fact that this happened in a vacuum. And I don't know if you coined it, but you have certainly popularized the concept that in most cases, these are not lone wolves who just sprung up on their own. In most cases, they're known wolves who have been investigated, who came up out of extremist networks and the jihadist mosques and all the rest of it. Is this the case again? Now, the Westminster killer, the guy who drove across a bridge and then tried to bust his way into Parliament in England, he seems to have come from one of the known wolf breeding grounds. Is this another case of the same thing?
Well, Jim, I think it is. And in fact, I did coin that term, known wolf, specifically because as I was looking at these cases in the U.S., in Europe, time and again, these terror suspects, or in some cases, people who actually pulled off their terror attacks, were already known to law enforcement, to intelligence, to national security officials. And that's exactly what we see in this case in Westminster. He was already on the radar. He had already been under investigation. And as I reported at PJ Media here over the weekend, the mosque in Luton, which is just a known hub of extremism, back in December 2010, a suicide bomber who tried to set off a bomb in Stockholm, he prematurely detonated and only ended up killing himself. And it turns out the Westminster killer and that Stockholm suicide bomber for 2010 were both very close friends, and Khalid Massoud, the Westminster killer, was a senior official at this mosque in Luton.
So here we go again, and it's part of, you know, Andy McCarthy coined another, I think, very useful term, willful blindness, in discussing the refusal to see the blisteringly obvious that's right in your face, and even to actually ignore it on purpose, which was one of the bigger problems with the Obama administration, and in many cases with the Brits as well, is we have jihadists in our midst, and we refuse to actually accept that fact out of some misguided idea that if we point it out, the rest of the Muslims who obviously can't control themselves if we say anything truthful would all turn into jihadists and cut our throats. Is that the problem?
Well, Jim, you might recall back when the ISIS started popping up on the media radar, and FBI Director Jim Comey, when he was asked about Americans who had traveled overseas to join ISIS, he said, well, you know, there are about a dozen guys. Well, and then that was immediately before the 2012 presidential election, when it was about a dozen. Well, then a couple months after the election in January, James Clapper, the then director of national intelligence, comes out and says, oh, we know of more than 100 of these guys. And we know that several dozen of those individuals have come back to the United States. How many have been prosecuted? Actually, very few. So we have these guys who the FBI knows that they've gone over, fought with terrorists. They've not been arrested. They've not been prosecuted. I can only think of probably, you know, maybe half a dozen cases in the past couple of years. So it's a serious problem. And it seems like no, as you point out, the willful blindness, you know, it's almost like a deliberate policy that we're not going to look at these guys.
Is it a case where we need to relook the actual, whether it's prosecutability or deportability or investigatability of people who show these signs, as you mentioned, you know, as they become known wolves in any way, can we go ahead and take action before technically they're a full-fledged wolf, before they get their first kill?
That's one of the things that I think Congress needs to look at is, are there prosecution tools that need to be developed? But point in fact, after 9/11, the Bush administration, to their credit, I think, they went up and they literally swept up hundreds of people who had been on their terror radar and, you know, arrested and convicted them on a number of unrelated terror charges, sometimes immigration fraud. You know, many of them were involved in criminal activity. And so they just swept these people up and prosecuted them on real charges, but they may not have been related to terrorism. Actually, the FBI counts them as terror cases, even if they weren't prosecuted for terrorism. So that's one of the things that we should be doing right now. But, Jim, we can't even get the Obama administration didn't prosecute anybody for terrorism support. You know, that's at the end of the Bush administration and the entirety of the Obama administration, it just seemed like this was not a priority. And time and again, all these cases, we see, you know, Fort Hood. I mean, I can go down the list.
I think the problem now is there is such a well-established chorus of apologists for the Islamists, you know, CARE and the rest of the Muslim organizations that purport to be social organizations and in reality spend most of their time doing PR that says nothing to see here, just move along. You know, they're the ones who would be up in arms the second you do any of this. But yet they stop us from taking a look at the equivalents to the Luton Mosque in England that we have here. And they will do everything possible to stop us from looking at the real problem and try to make it back to that lone wolf concept. Do you think we can overcome that and actually do the right thing now?
Well, that's what I think a lot of people are looking to Attorney General Sessions to do. And, you know, while he was in the U.S. Senate, he certainly talked a lot about that in the, on the Judiciary Committee. And, you know, I worked with his staff on some of these issues. That it remains to be seen. And, you know, the apologists are going to scream. They were screaming back after 9/11 when the Bush administration was scooping these suspects up. The media is always going to cover for them. We need some, you know, leaders to, like Jeff Sessions, like the Trump administration, to say, this is what we're going to do and do it, despite all the apologists.
So it's going to take, now there is, I mean, prosecutorial discretion is a two-way street. During the Obama administration, it was willful blindness. They were not just looking the other way. They were, in many cases, working with the Islamist apologist groups, with the, you know, the bad guys, and inviting them in to be advisors. That can change. As you mentioned, you know, Jeff Sessions is the top law enforcement official in the United States. If he decides these are prosecutable, the truth changes.
Yes. And again, it remains to be seen what the policy of this administration, if they're going to be aggressive or not. Yeah, Jim, my concern is that we see these attacks, and I reported to PJ Media here over the weekend, we're seeing these attacks on nearly a daily basis over in Europe. And unfortunately, we have two vast oceans that remove us from a lot of the problems that we're seeing in Europe. But my fear is we're going to start seeing that here at some point. And when we do, I think we're going to see, you know, our policy is not going to be deliberate. It's going to be reactive. and we're going to overreact, or we're going to put focus where we shouldn't be. This is something that Congress should be talking about right now, and they're not.
Patrick Poole, National Security and Terrorism Correspondent for PJ Media. Thanks so much for joining us. Up next, we will talk with Meg Opria after the break. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Megan Opria. She is senior contributor at The Federalist and editor of Inbound, a daily foreign affairs news and insight journal. Meg, I want to find out what you think about Donald Trump's strike in retaliation for the chemical attacks in Syria. Now, I got to say, I am kind of an absolutist on the whole concept of any use of weapons of mass destruction, I believe, requires a forceful response from the world community. And since the world community doesn't exist, that kind of boils down to the United States. You know, like it or not, we are the only one capable of serving as the world's policeman. You know, when the world dials 911, the phone rings at the Pentagon, all those wonderful things about it. And that doesn't mean we respond to every humanitarian crisis or every tragedy, even every mini genocide. But sometimes you have to make a point. And it's not like we can wait on the UN. You know, the UN is kind of like when Stalin was asked about the Vatican's army. He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? The UN's got none. So it's us or nobody. Do you think Trump did the right thing in at least making a retaliation against Assad?
Yeah, I do. I agree with what you said. I think that he made the right decision. I think something like chemical weapons it's just a non-starter. There's no choice. We have to maintain the international norms on chemical weapons that we've been trying to maintain since World War One. And I think that there's a lot of people who are saying, well, listen, we don't need to act. And I think that they are sort of enjoying the comfort of the fact that we have basically prohibited chemical weapons, you know, for the last 100 years. And so it seems very distant from people. But absolutely, that's a non-starter. And I think that he made the right move.
So having done that, now what do we do? It gets very interesting, because that's the easy part. You know, it's pretty easy to push the button, launch a bunch of tomahawks, make some rubble, which then can't make trouble. But the guy who owns the rest of Syria, okay, he's missing a few of his toys, but he's still in power. And it looks dangerously possible that the Russians either knew about this and did nothing, or may have even been complicit. So we've got a bigger problem with what happens next in Syria. Do you think there's going to be any interesting talks with Secretary of State Tillerson in Russia this week?
Yeah, I think those talks are going to be much more interesting than they were going to be this time last week. I think it sort of remains to be seen what's going to happen on both fronts. I think in terms of Syria, we need to wait and see, is Assad going to take this as a hint of, okay, I can't go there anymore. That remains to be seen. It's not clear. And in terms of Russia, I think Tillerson is heading to Russia, is in Russia, at least with sort of in a better bargaining position than he was before the strikes. Now, he can say, listen, we're serious, we mean business. And I think there's some indications that maybe Russia wasn't too pleased with what Syria did, and maybe it's blustering on the outside in order to sort of save face. The hope would be that they will back down behind the scenes, but again, that remains to be seen.
And, you know, there's been talk. Tillerson said that we need to do something. You know, there's been talk potentially about regime change being the policy for Syria. I think at some level that requires, if not assent, probably even more so assistance from Putin. Is it possible that we could say, okay, here's the deal. Assad is so bad, so tainted, such a disgusting, uncivilized human being. He's got to go. But you guys can pick a new tyrant. You know, you can pick a new puppet. Because Russia's not going to give up its warm water port. They're not going to give up the leverage that essentially running, you know, Syria as a puppet regime gives them. Can we let them pick the new bad guy?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that they're not going to agree to just completely bowing out. And I think we are going to have to press for Russian assistance if we want to have any kind of a peaceful transfer of power, although I could hardly call it peaceful. Whether or not they'll cooperate, my guess is that they are going to probably insist on some kind of a waiting period, some kind of a face-saving period, and that they will then eventually agree to help with it. Whether or not they choose somebody that's good, that's the tough one to say.
Let's back the lens up a little bit. I have a cunning plan for the region, and I outlined it in the opening segment of the show tonight. And I'm going to lay it on you and help me pick it apart, because I have no belief that any of this is easy. But I think we're operating in Iraq and Syria from a fundamental mistake, which was created when the artificial lines on the map that created Iraq and Syria in the post-colonial era were drawn. There are no actual reasons why Iraq and Syria have the borders they do. It has nothing to do with the people there. It has nothing to do with their self-determination. Especially in Iraq, you've got Kurds and Sunni and Shia, none of whom get along particularly well, all drawn inside one border because that was easier when we were breaking up the colonial empires. In Syria, you've got an Alawite minority led by Assad. You've got a large Sunni population. You've got a bunch of other minorities. And that Sunni population essentially crosses the border into Iraq, and that is where ISIS now runs their caliphate. So ISIS erased the border between Iraq and Syria in any meaningful way during their reign of terror. So my idea, and I'm not saying there is any way to implement this easily, is let's give self-determination to the groups. Let's have a Shia Iraq in the Shia areas. Let's take the Sunni in Iraq and Syria and let them have a tribal council and some sort of self-determination. The Kurds already have a state in Iraq. Let's formally recognize it. And then let's minimize the rule of Assad or his, follow-on chosen dictator, and have another Syria that doesn't include the minorities that they're oppressing. Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy, although you're right in terms of how to implement that. I think what your plan and what your idea draws to the forefront, which is incredibly important, is specifically the Sunni problem. And it's mainly been talked about in Iraq. But as you pointed out, it's a huge problem in Syria as well, because the Alawite minority is in control and the Sunni majority is not. And so this brings up sort of the failing post-surge. The surge in 2007 was successful because it identified that the Sunni population in Iraq had to have some sense of security, that they were going to be a part of the political process moving forward. And when Obama came to the presidency and said, well, war was drawn, we're going to get out of here, we're not following through with all this, it crumbled and left this vacuum for ISIS to come and say, like, hey, you're nobody cares about you, we care about you, right? And so what your plan highlights, which is incredibly important, is that if the Sunni population doesn't feel safe and secure and like they're part of the process, there will never be stability in that region.
And maybe it's a baby steps. Maybe we do. The Kurds got a semi-autonomous region, and they've done quite well with that. The problem is the Sunni don't have natural resources. Oil makes everything easier. Right now, the Kurds have an oil deal with the Turks, and consequently, they can kind of thumb their nose at the Baghdad government. The Sunni have some farmland, but not really a self-sustaining in a meaningful way ability to have a nation state. So maybe there's a need to make them autonomous, give them some foreign aid, develop something that at least puts them on the path to self-determination. But I just don't know why we would continue to push a failed pair of nation states that nobody's happy with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult situation. And when you add in there that Iran is sort of like whispering in the ear of the Iraqi government, saying you've got to make sure that the Sunnis don't rise up, it just creates this toxic mess.
Yeah, I don't know that they're just whispering. I think they're sitting at the table. Yeah. In many cases, the Iraqi or the Iranian Revolutionary Guards are leading the charge through the Sunni regions in Iraq. And then you've got the Iranian-backed Shia militias who are following on the regular forces and looting and pillaging and slaughtering Sunni civilians. So I don't know how you manage to say, even if you push ISIS out, how is the Baghdad government, and which is Shia and dominated and Iranian dominated, going to rule that region once ISIS is gone?
Right, and that's a big part of the problem, is that it was our backing away from Iraq and saying, well, we don't want to be involved anymore, that it left this window for Iran to come in and, like you said, not just whisper, but basically be at the table.
Well, they haven't done anybody any favors, and I think now that Obama's gone, at least we can know that we don't have to treat the Iranians as an ally. They never have been, and they never will be. And so, Megan Apriya, senior contributor at The Federalist, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Up next, we'll be talking with Kevin Freeman. This is Jim Hansen, and you are listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Kevin Freeman, who is the author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy. Kevin, there is a lot going on from a national security perspective, but I always find it interesting that you can put at least a viewpoint of how economic policy and growth and situations have a fairly profound effect on our national security. And you got a piece you wrote talking about how growth is a national security priority for the United States. And I just wanted to give our listeners a little bit of an idea of why that is and how it affects our security.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. The bottom line is that we beat the Soviet Union by outgrowing them. Economic warfare has long been a part of national security strategy. It's the strategy that was adopted by the Chinese in 1999, and they had an incredible run of growth, and they've become now an international power. It's the strategy that's been adopted by the United States, but long ignored under the Obama administration, where we didn't grow any more than 2% during any one single year. But it is absolutely necessary that we grow our economy in order to afford the defense that we have, in order to keep the policies in place that are pro-freedom policies. People tend to follow their own economic well-being and how they vote and how they think and so forth. So yes, absolutely, growth, economics, and national security are intertwined.
So let's go pro-growth, and that seems to have been one of President Trump's big items he ran as a candidate on. And one of the things he's talked about is taking the shackles off of U.S. industry and companies and productivity by removing a lot of the regulation that just seems to be the main product of the state here in Washington is creating regulations. And I always thought he should get one of those giant industrial shredders and put it out on the East Lawn at the White House, and then every Friday have his aides wheel out a bunch of giant dollies full of regulations and just toss him in the shredder as he announces they're being removed. I mean, is that a good start?
Yeah, that's a great idea. In fact, we need to understand the opposite. The Chinese wrote a book in 1999, it's published by the People's Liberation Army Press. It was written by two senior colonels, one of whom is now a general that runs their National Defense University. And it basically said the way to beat America is to undermine them by getting them bogged up in mass regulation, slow their economy, get them to where literally they are no longer growing, and then we outgrow them. They actually talk about regulatory strategy, and Putin is famous that he was actually funding anti-fracking efforts, increase the regulations on hydraulic fracking in order to stop the American energy boom.
Before we get to Russia and all of that, I wanted to ask you that Chinese growth policies, as you mentioned, were very successful. Were they real in the end? Did they actually grow in a way that's going to stay, or is part of it a facade?
Well, initially the growth was absolutely real. They were coming from a very agrarian society, but they have a misallocation of capital that comes whenever you try and centrally direct an economy. You end up getting pet projects and misallocations of capital, and the free market does a much, much better job. But yes, there were large. The Chinese economy has grown in large part in real terms. Lately, more recently, though, the misallocation of capital has allowed for really bad loans and banking sector problems and so forth that people like Gordon Chang have picked up on. And right now, their economy is not on solid footing. It is a house of cards.
Let's talk about the other big dog in the global economy, Russia. Now, obviously, you mentioned that they put some money into anti-fracking efforts to try and, you know, slow down our ability to be, if not energy independent, at least less energy dependent on sources of energy from our enemies. What else is Russia involved in, both from, you know, their internal policies to grow their economy and do what they can, and ability to kind of mess with us and slow us down?
Well, Russia has also serious economic problems. They have one real main export, and they're developing a second, which is a little bit scary. But their primary export has been oil and gas, and they've used that as an economic weapon. What they've built more recently are cyber efforts, both, and they have some of the top cyber protection labs are located in Russia, and that's a potential national security risk if, as long as American companies are adopting Russian companies as their cyber protections, but also cyber hacking. They have, so that's become a growth industry in Russia, and it's a serious threat to the world. All of that centers around the idea that Vladimir Putin understands that we're in a global economic war. And he's long said that we've got to displace the America from the preeminent position. We've got to remove the dollar as the world's reserve currency. We've got to create alternative structures. And he's been working with the Chinese now for a number of years, specifically since 2013, but he was trying even before that, to reestablish the global economic order. And we've got to understand that. When I tried to bring this to the administration, the Obama administration, they would hear nothing of it. Russia wouldn't do that, and they wouldn't interfere with America. Why would they do that? Of course, they've changed their tune given the last election.
Well, now, let me ask then, is there any chance, I mean, Russia and China have a fairly solid frenemy relationship. What you just outlined would be about as big and bad a thing for us as possible if they actually went after, you know, the dollar as reserve currency or anything. Can they find enough common ground to do that?
That's a good question. They could not in 2008, when Hank Paulson, our then Treasury Secretary, was told by the Chinese that Russia was trying to collapse Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and force the Treasury to bail them out and collapse our economy. That was mentioned in Hank Paulson's memoirs, On the Brink. So they did not get China to join them in 2008. They did get China to at least provide rhetoric around this in 2013 when the Chinese said we must remove the dollar as reserve currency of the world. And I think it's interesting that the president was dining with Xi in I guess he was in Florida at the moment we were ordering the missile strikes because that was putting a potential dividing wedge between Russian and Chinese interests.
Let's go back to Putin. He's obviously got economic issues. Are they going to be driven by economic problems at home to be more expansionist on the global, you know, geopolitical, geostrategic stage?
Putin's in a pretty precarious but interesting position. He may be the richest man in the world based on what he controls, which some estimate as much as $200 billion under the control of Putin. But his economy is not in great shape. The one thing he has going for him is the incredible resilience of the Russian people. They've survived Nazi invasions and everything else. They're very resilient people. But he may be in a very... So he's got to get some wins on the board to keep his approval rating at home. And he's got to show Russian economic strength. And so I believe he is absolutely adventurous, and he is putting money all around the world where he can, given the fact that Russia has a limited economy and it's not in tremendous shape. So I think you mentioned an article that Bloomberg has that a declining value of the ruble. That would benefit him because it would allow him to export his oil and receive more value at home for it.
Well, that, unfortunately, an adventurous Putin is not something that we really want, but we'll deal with it. You know, let's see what Secretary of State Tillerson comes back from Moscow saying. Kevin Freeman, thanks for joining us. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow to give you more ammunition in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.